Oh, I'm so hurt, Mandy said in mock outrage. She turned to Rachel with a placid smile. I feel like I have an unfair advantage since I've heard loads about you. You have? Rachel couldn't hide her look of surprise. Why had Nick never once mentioned this friend of his, this beautiful girl who inexplicably kept calling him Nico? Rachel gave Nick a measured look, but he simply smiled back, oblivious to the nagging thoughts filling her mind. Well, I suppose we ought to get back to the reception, Mandy suggested. As the foursome made their way toward the stairs, Mandy halted abruptly. Oh, look, Nico, I can't believe it, it's still here. She traced her fingers over a section of the wall right beside the staircase. Rachel peered at the wall and saw the names, Nico and Mandy, carved into the rock, joined together by an infinity symbol. Chapter 6, Tyersall Park, Singapore. Alexandra walked onto the veranda to find her sister, Victoria, and her daughter-in-law, Fiona, having afternoon tea with her mother. Victoria looked rather comical with a dramatic opera-length necklace of mine-cut cognac diamonds casually draped over her gingham shirt. Obviously, Mummy was doling out jewelry again, something she seemed to be doing with greater frequency these days. I've been labeling every piece in the vault and putting them in cases marked with all your names, Suyi had informed Alexandra during her visit last year. This way there is no fighting after I'm gone. There won't be any fighting, Mummy, Alexandra had insisted. You say that now, but look what happened to Madame Lim Boon Peck's family. Or the Hu sisters. Whole families torn apart over jewelry, and not even very good jewelry, Suyi had sighed. As Alexandra approached the wrought iron table where sweetly aromatic kue lapis cake and pineapple tarts were arrayed on long quan celadon dishes, Suyi was taking out a diamond and cabochon sapphire choker. This one, my father brought back from Shanghai in 1918, Suyi said to Fiona in Cantonese. My mother told me it belonged to a Grand Duchess who had escaped Russia on the Trans-Siberian Railway with all her jewels sewn into the lining of her coat. Here, try it on. Fiona put the choker around her neck, and one of Suyi's Thai ladies' maids helped to fasten the delicate antique clasp. The other maid held up a hand mirror, and Fiona peered at her reflection. Even in the waning late afternoon light, the sapphires glistened against her neck. It's truly exquisite, Ama. I've always liked it because these sapphires are so translucent. I've never quite seen a shade of blue like that, Suyi said. Fiona handed back the necklace, and Suyi slipped it into a yellow silk pouch before handing it to Fiona. Nah, you should wear it tonight to the wedding banquet. Oh, Ama, I couldn't possibly, Fiona began. Ayah, Mokok, hey, it's yours now. Make sure it goes to Callista someday, Suyi decreed. She turned to Alexandra and said, do you need something for tonight? Alexandra shook her head. I brought my triple strand pearls. You always wear those pearls, Victoria complained, casually twirling her new diamonds around her fingers as if they were toy beads. I like my pearls. Besides, I don't want to look like one of those coup women. Did you see how much jewelry they piled on this morning? Ridiculous. Those coups sure like to flaunt it, don't they? Victoria said with a laugh, popping one of the crumbly pineapple tarts into her mouth. Ayah, who cares? Ku Tek Fong's father came from a little village in Sarawak. I will always know him as the man who used to buy my mother's old silver, Suyi said dismissively. Now, speaking of jewelry, I want to talk about Alistair's girlfriend. That starlet. Alexandra flinched, steeling herself for the onslaught. Yes, Mummy, I'm sure you were as appalled as I was by that woman's behavior today. The audacity of her to accept that ring from the Sultana. It was so undignified, not to mention, Victoria began. Su Yi held out her hand to silence Victoria. Why wasn't I told that Alistair was engaged to her? It just happened a few days ago, Alexandra said bleakly. But who is she? Who are her people? I don't know precisely, Alexandra said. How is it possible that you don't know the family when your son wants to take her as his wife? Su Yi said in astonishment. Look at Fiona here. We have known her family for generations. Fiona, do you know this girl's family? Fiona grimaced, making no attempt to hide her disdain. Amma, I never set eyes on her until 2 days ago at Auntie Felicity's. Cassandra told me the girl showed up at Felicity's wearing a see-through dress. Is that true? Su Yi asked. Yes, the three ladies droned in unison. Tiana, what is this world coming to? Su Yi shook her head, taking a slow sip from her teacup. Clearly, the girl has not been brought up well, Victoria said. She's not been brought up at all. She's not Taiwanese, even though she claims to be, and she's certainly not from Hong Kong. I've heard that she is from some remote village in northern China, Fiona offered. Tsk. Those northern Chinese are the worst, Victoria huffed, nibbling on a buttery slice of kue lapis. Where she's from is irrelevant. My youngest grandson is not going to marry some actress, especially one of questionable lineage, Su Yi said simply. Turning to Alexandra, she said, You will tell him to break off the engagement immediately. His father has agreed to talk to him when we return to Hong Kong. I don't think that will be soon enough, Alex. The girl needs to be sent packing before she does something more offensive. I can only imagine what she's going to wear to the ball tonight, Victoria said. Well, what about Rachel, that girlfriend of Nikki's? Alexandra said, trying to deflect the focus from her son. What about her? Su Yi asked, puzzled. Aren't you concerned about her as well? I mean, we know nothing of her family. She's just a pretty girl that Nikki's having fun with. Su Yi laughed as if the idea of him marrying Rachel was too ridiculous to even consider. That's not the way it looks to me, Alexandra warned. Nonsense. Nikki has no intentions with this girl. He told me so himself. And besides, he would never do anything without my permission. Alistair simply needs to obey your wishes, Su Yi said with finality. Mummy, I'm not sure it's that simple. That boy can be so stubborn. I tried to get him to stop dating her months ago, but Alexandra began. Alex, why don't you just threaten to cut him off? Stop his allowance or something, Victoria suggested. Allowance? He doesn't get an allowance. Alistair isn't concerned about money. He supports himself with those odd jobs on film, so he has always done exactly as he pleases. You know, Alistair might not care about money, but I'll bet you that trollop does, Victoria expostulated. Alex, you need to give her a good talking to. Make her understand that it is impossible for her to marry Alistair and that you will cut him off forever if she does. I don't know how I would even begin, Alexandra said. Why don't you talk to her, Victoria? You're so good at this sort of thing. Me? Good grief. I don't intend to exchange a single word with that girl, Victoria declared. Tiana, you are all hopeless, Su Yi groaned. Turning to one of her lady's maids, she ordered, Call Oliver Tian. Tell him to come over right away. On the way home from the wedding reception, Nick had assured Rachel that his relationship with Mandy was ancient history. We dated on and off till I was 18 and went off to Oxford. It was puppy love. Now we're just old friends who meet up every once in a while. You know, she lives in New York, but we hardly ever meet. She's way too busy going to Avis parties with that Z fellow, Nick said. Still, Rachel had sensed a distinctly territorial vibe coming from Mandy back at the fort, making her wonder if Mandy was truly over Nick. Now, as she was getting dressed for the most formal event she had ever been invited to, she wondered how she would compare to Mandy and all the other impossibly chic women in Nick's orbit. She stood in front of the mirror, assessing herself. Her hair had been swept up into a loose French twist and pinned with three violet orchid blossoms, and she was wearing a midnight blue off-the-shoulder gown that draped elegantly across her hips before flaring out just above the knees into luxuriant folds of silk organza scattered with tiny freshwater pearls. She scarcely recognized herself. There was a jaunty rap on the door. "Are you decent?" Nick called out. "Yes, come in," Rachel replied. Nick opened the bedroom door and stopped dead in his tracks. "Oh, wow," he said. "You like it?" Rachel asked bashfully. "You look stunning," Nick said, almost in a whisper. "Did these flowers in my hair look silly?" "Not at all." Nick circled around her, admiring how the thousands of pearls shimmered like faraway stars. "It makes you look glamorous and exotic at the same time." "Thanks. You look pretty awesome yourself," Rachel declared, admiring how utterly debonair Nick looked in his dinner jacket, with its streamlined grosgrain lapels perfectly accentuating his crisp white bow tie. "Ready for your carriage?" Nick asked, entwining his arm through hers in a courtly manner. "I guess so," Rachel said, exhaling deeply. As they walked out of the bedroom, little Augustine Cheng came racing down the corridor. "Whoa, Augustine, you're going to break your neck," Nick said, stopping him in his tracks. The little boy looked terrified. "What's wrong, little man?" Nick asked.
"I need to hide," Augustine was panting.
"Why?"
"Papa's after me. I spilled orange Fanta all over his new suit."
"Oh, no," Rachel said, trying not to giggle.
"He said he was going to kill me,"
the boy said, shaking with tears in his eyes.
"Oh, he'll get over it. Come with us. I'll make sure your father doesn't kill you,"
Nick laughed, taking Augustine by the hand. At the bottom of the stairs, Eddie was arguing in Cantonese with Ling Che, the head housekeeper, and Nasi, the head laundry maid, while Fiona stood next to him in her Weimaraner gray evening gown looking exasperated.
"I'm telling you, this type of fabric needs to soak for a few hours if you want to get the stain out properly," the head laundry maid explained.
"A few hours? But we need to be at the wedding ball by 7:30. This is an emergency. Do you understand?"
Eddie shouted, glaring at the ballet woman as if she didn't understand English.
"Eddie, there's no need to raise your voice. She understands," Fiona said. "How many laundry maids does my grandmother keep? There must be at least 10 of you. Don't tell me you people can't fix this right now,"
Eddie complained to Ling Che.
"Eddie boy, even if there were 20 of them, there's no way it will be ready for tonight," Ling Che insisted. "But what am I going to wear? I had this tux specially made for me in Milan. Do you know how much it cost me?" "I'm sure it was very, very expensive, and that's exactly why we need to be gentle and let the stain lift properly," Ling Che said, shaking her head. Eddie boy had been a pompous little monster even when he was 5.
Eddie glanced up the staircase and noticed Augustine coming down with Nick and Rachel.
"You little shit," he screamed. "Eddie, control yourself," Fiona admonished. "I'm going to teach him a lesson he'll never forget."
Incandescent with rage, Eddie began to storm up the stairs.
"Stop it, Eddie,"
Fiona said, grabbing hold of his arm.
"You're wrinkling my shirt, Fee," Eddie scowled. "Like mother, like son. Eddie, you need to calm down. Just wear one of the other two tuxes you brought," Fiona said in a measured tone. "Don't be stupid. I've already worn both of those the past 2 nights. I had everything perfectly planned until this little bastard came along. Stop hiding, you little bastard. Be a man and accept your punishment."
Eddie broke free from his wife and lunged toward the boy with his right arm outstretched. Augustine whimpered, cowering behind Nick.
"Eddie, you're not really going to hit your 6-year-old son over a harmless accident, are you?"
Nick said lightheartedly.
"Harmless? Fucky fuck! He's ruined everything! The monochromatic fashion statement I was planning for the whole family is ruined because of him! And you've just ruined the whole trip for me," Fiona suddenly blurted out. "I am so sick of all this!
Why is it so damn important for us to look picture perfect every time we walk out the door? Who exactly are you trying to impress? The photographers? The readers of Hong Kong Tattle? You really care so much about them that you'd rather hit your own son over an accident that you caused in the first place by screaming at him for wearing the wrong cummerbund? But, Eddie sputtered in protest.
Fiona turned to Nick, her serene expression returning.
Nick, can my children and I ride with you to the ball?
If you'd like, Nick said cautiously, not wanting to further incite his cousin.
Good. I have no desire to be seen with a tyrant.
Fiona took Augustine by the hand and started up the stairs. She paused for a moment as she passed Rachel.
You look amazing in that dress. But you know what? It needs something.
Fiona proceeded to take off the sapphire and diamond choker she had just been given by Su Yi and placed it around Rachel's neck.
Now the outfit looks complete. I insist that you borrow it for tonight.
You're too kind, but what will you wear? Rachel asked in astonishment.
Oh, don't worry about me, Fiona said, giving her husband a dark stare. I'm not going to be wearing a single piece of jewelry tonight. I was born a tongue, and I have nothing to prove to anyone.
Chapter 7 Pasir Panjang Road, Singapore.
Never, never let young people plan their own weddings, because this is what you end up with.
Mrs. Lee Yong-Chien fumed to Puan Sri Mavis Un. They were standing in the middle of an enormous warehouse in the Keppel shipyard, along with 700 other VIPs and VVIPs, utterly baffled by the Cuban band dressed in 40s Tropicana splendor on the stage. People like Mrs. Lee were used to only one kind of Chinese wedding banquet, the kind that took place in the grand ballroom of a 5-star hotel. There would be the gorging on salted peanuts during the interminable wait for the 14-course dinner to begin, the melting ice sculptures, the outlandish floral centerpieces, the society matron invariably offended by the faraway table she had been placed at, the entrance of the bride, the malfunctioning smoke machine, the entrance of the bride again and again in 5 different gowns throughout the night, the crying child choking on a fishball, the 3 dozen speeches by politicians, token Angmore executives and assorted high-ranking officials of no relation to the wedding couple, the cutting of the 12-tier cake, someone's mistress making a scene, the not-so-subtle counting of wedding cash envelopes by some cousin, the ghastly Canto pop star flown in from Hong Kong to scream some pop song, a chance for the older crowd to take an extended toilet break, the distribution of tiny wedding fruitcakes with white icing in paper boxes to all the departing guests, and then, yum sing, the final toast would be made, the whole affair would be over, and everyone would make the mad dash to the hotel lobby to wait 30 minutes for their car and driver to make it through the traffic jam. Tonight, however, there was none of that. There was just an industrial space with waiters bearing mojitos and a woman with short, slicked-back hair in a white tuxedo belting out, Bésame mucho. Glancing around, Rachel was amused by the looks of bafflement on the faces of the arriving guests decked out in their most ostentatious finery. These women really brought out the big guns tonight, didn't they? Rachel whispered to Nick as she eyed a woman sporting a cape of metallic gold feathers.
Sure looks like it. Was that Queen Nefertiti who just walked by?
Nick joked.
Shut your mouth, Nicholas. That's Patsy Wang. She's a Hong Kong socialite renowned for her avant-garde style. There are dozens of blogs out there devoted to her,
Oliver commented. Who's the guy with her? The one in the diamond-studded jacket who looks like he's wearing eyeshadow? Rachel queried.
That's her husband, Adam, and he is wearing eyeshadow, Oliver answered.
They're married? Really? Rachel raised a doubting eyebrow.
Yes, and they even have 3 children to prove it. You have to understand, many Hong Kong men revel in being fashionistas. They are dandies in the truest sense of the word. How flamboyantly dressed they might be is no indication of which team they play on.
Fascinating, Rachel said.
You can always tell Singapore men from Hong Kong men, Nick chimed in. We're the ones dressed like we're still wearing our school uniforms, while they look more like David Bowie impersonators.
Oliver finished. Thanks, Ollie. I was going to go with Elton John, Nick chuckled. As if on cue, the lights in the warehouse dimmed and the loading dock doors behind the stage began to rise, revealing a line of sleek white ferries waiting harborside. Flaming torches lit the way to the pier, and a line of men dressed in Swedish sailor outfits stood ready to guide the guests onto the ferries. The crowd roared in approval. "The other shoe drops," Oliver said gleefully. "Where do you think we're going?" Rachel asked. "You'll soon see," Nick said with a wink. As the guests streamed onto the pier, Astrid made sure to board the ferry carrying a mix of international guests, rather than the one filled with her nosy relatives. She had already been asked, "Where's Michael?" too many times, and was sick of parroting new variations of her excuse. As she leaned against the railing at the back of the ferry, peering at the frothy waves as the vessel pulled away from the embankment, she felt someone staring at her. She turned to see Charlie Wu, her old flame, on the upper deck. Charlie flushed bright red when he realized he'd been caught staring. He hesitated for a moment and then decided to come downstairs.
"Long time no see," he said as nonchalantly as possible. In fact, it had been almost 10 years since that fateful day when Astrid had thrown a Frosty in his face outside of the old Wendy's on Orchard Road.
"Yes," Astrid said with an apologetic smile. She assessed him for a moment, thinking that he looked better with a little age on him. Those rimless glasses suited him, his gangly frame had filled out, and the once problematic acne scarring now gave his face a finely weathered look.
"How's life treating you? You moved to Hong Kong a few years ago, didn't you?"
"I can't complain. Too busy with work, but isn't that the case with everyone?" Charlie mused.
"Well, not everyone owns the largest digital technology company in Asia. Aren't they calling you the Asian Steve Jobs these days?"
"Yeah, unfortunately. Impossible shoes to fill."
Charlie looked at her again, unsure of what to say. She looked more exquisite than ever in that chartreuse cheongsam.
"Funny how you could be so intimate with someone for so many years and yet feel so painfully awkward around them now."
"So I hear you got married to some hotshot army guy and you have a son?"
"Yes, Cassian. He's 3, Astrid replied, adding preemptively, "and my husband works in the tech industry like you now. He had to run off to China at the last minute to handle some huge system meltdown. And you have a son and a daughter, don't you?"
"No, 2 daughters. Still no boy yet, much to my mother's dismay. But my brother Rob has 3 boys, which keeps her placated for the time being."
"And your wife, is she here tonight?" Astrid asked.
"No, no, I'm the only one flying the flag for my family. You know, they only invited 888 guests, so I hear that unless you were family, a head of state, or a member of royalty, your spouse didn't get invited."
"Is that so?" Astrid laughed. "I treated Charlie horribly. He didn't deserve to be chucked aside like that, but everyone was putting so much pressure on me about marrying Wu Haolian's son back in those days."
There was an awkward silence, but they were thankfully saved by the gasps of astonishment from the crowd. The ferry was fast approaching one of the outlying islands, and coming into view was what looked like a crystal palace glowing in the middle of the dense forest. Charlie and Astrid stared in awe as the full complexity of the structure became apparent. The cathedral-like banquet hall consisted of immense trapezoidal canopies of glass that were seemingly integrated into the tropical rainforest. Trees grew out from some of the glass panels, while others were contained within its dramatically angled panes. Intersecting the main structure were cantilevered terraces of varying heights, with a profusion of tropical vines and flowers spilling out over each terrace. The whole place looked like a futuristic Hanging Gardens of Babylon, and standing at the harbor promenade, flanked by a row of travertine columns, were Colin and Araminta, both dressed in white, waving to the arriving guests. Astrid took one look at them and deadpanned in a Latin accent.
"Welcome to Fantasy Island!" Charlie laughed. He had forgotten her wacky sense of humor.
"I guess this is how you spend $40 million on a wedding," Astrid remarked dryly.
"Oh, that thing costs way more than $40 million, Charlie said.
Araminta, in a pleated white chiffon silk gown with long straps of hammered gold and diamond links that crisscrossed her bodice, greeted her guests.
Her hair was piled high into a mound of intricate braids and festooned with diamonds, baroque pearls, and moonstones. As the gown billowed around her in the ocean breeze, she could have been mistaken for an Etruscan goddess. Standing at her side, looking a little worn out from the day's festivities, was Colin in a white linen tuxedo. Looking through the crowd, Araminta asked Colin, "Do you see your cousin Astrid anywhere?"
"I saw her brothers, but I haven't spotted her yet," Colin answered.
"Let me know the minute you spot her. I need to know what she's wearing tonight."
"I spy Astrid disembarking from the third ferry," Colin reported.
"Alamak! She's wearing a cheongsam. Why didn't she wear one of her fabulous couture creations?" Araminta sighed.
"I think she looks lovely, and that cheongsam was probably handmade. But I was waiting to see what designer she would turn up in. I go to all this trouble, and she doesn't even bother to make the effort. What's the whole fucking point of this wedding?" Araminta moaned.
When the last boatload of guests had disembarked, the illuminated crystalline facade of the banquet hall suddenly morphed into an intense shade of fuchsia. Haunting New Age music boomed from the surrounding forest, and the trees were bathed in golden light. Slowly, almost imperceptibly, golden cords descended from the thick foliage. Wrapped cocoon-like in these cords were acrobats with bodies that had been painted gold.
"Oh my goodness, I think it's Cirque du Soleil," the guests began murmuring excitedly.
As the acrobats started to unfurl and spin around the cords as effortlessly as lemurs, the crowd broke into rapturous applause. Kitty jumped up and down like a hyperactive child.
"You seem to be having a good time," Oliver said,
sidling up next to her and noticing that her breast didn't seem to jiggle naturally inside that lacy turquoise gown. He also noticed that she had a thin sheen of body glitter on.
"Bad combo," he thought.
"I love Cirque du Soleil. I've gone to every single one of their performances in Hong Kong. Now, I must have these acrobats at my wedding, too."
"My goodness, that will be costly," Oliver said in exaggerated awe.
"Oh, Alistair can handle it," Kitty replied breezily.
"You think so? I didn't realize Alistair was doing that well in the movie business."
"Yeah, don't you think his parents will pay for the wedding?"
Kitty said as she stared at the gold-painted acrobats while they began to form a human arch.
"Are you kidding me?"
Oliver lowered his voice, continuing,
"Do you have any idea how cheap his mother is?"
"She is?
Haven't you been to that flat of theirs on Robinson Road?"
No, I was never invited."
"That's probably because Alistair was too embarrassed to show it to you. It's a very basic three-bedroom flat. Alistair had to share a bedroom with his brother until he went to college. I went to visit in 1991, and there were these yellow floral bath mats in the toilet. And when I went again last month, the yellow floral bath mats were still there, except they are a grayish floral now."
"Really?"
Kitty said in disbelief.
"Well, look at his mother. You think she wears those old 80s dresses on purpose? She wears them to save money."
"But I thought Alistair's father is a famous heart doctor."
Kitty was confused. Oliver paused. Thank God she didn't seem to know about the Chang's massive real estate holdings.
"Do you have any idea how much malpractice insurance costs these days? Doctors don't make as much money as you think. Do you know how much it costs to send three children to study overseas? Eddie went to Cambridge, Cecilia went to UBC in Vancouver, and Alistair, well, you know how long Alistair took to graduate from Sydney University. The Changs spent most of their savings on their children's education."
"I had no idea."
"And you know how Malcolm is. He's a traditional Cantonese man. What remaining money he has will all go to his eldest son."
Kitty went quiet, and Oliver prayed he hadn't laid it on too thick.
"But of course I know none of that is important to you," he added.
"You're in love, and you don't really need Cirque du Soleil performing at your wedding, do you? I mean, you'll get to stare at that cute puppy dog face of Alistair's every morning for the rest of your life. That's worth all the money in the world, isn't it?"
Chapter 8 Palau Samsara, off the southern coast of Singapore. At 9 o'clock sharp, the wedding ball attendees were led into the vast banquet hall set amid the indigenous tropical rainforest. Along the south walls were archways that led to grotto-like alcoves, while the curved north wall consisted of a curtain of glass that overlooked a man-made lagoon and a dramatic waterfall tumbling over moss-covered boulders. All along the edge of the lagoon, a profusion of exotic flowers and plants seemed to glow in iridescent colors.
"Do they build all this just for the wedding banquet?"
Carol Tai asked in astonishment.
"No la, those Lees always have business on their mind. This building is the centerpiece of a new luxury eco-resort they are developing. Palau Samsara, they're calling it," her husband revealed.
"What? Are they going to try to sell us condos after the wedding cake is served?"
Lorena Lim sniggered.
"They can give this resort some fancy new name, but I know for a fact the island used to be called Palau Hantu, Ghost Island. It was one of the outlying islands where the Japanese soldiers took all the young, able-bodied Chinese men and had them shot during World War II. This island is haunted with ghosts of the war dead,"
Daisy Fu whispered.
"Alamak, Daisy, if you truly have faith in the Lord, you won't believe in such things as ghosts,"
Carol admonished.
"Well, what about the Holy Ghost, Carol? Isn't he a ghost too?"
Daisy retorted. Minutes after Rachel and Nick were seated, the dinner began with military precision as a battalion of waiters marched in with glowing LED dome trays. The engraved menu card indicated that it was giant South Sea scallop consommé with Washington State ginseng vapors and black mushrooms. But Rachel wasn't quite sure what to do when the white-gloved waiter at her side lifted the shimmering dome off her plate. In front of her was a bowl, but encasing the surface of the bowl was what appeared to be a pinkish membrane-like bubble that wobbled on its own accord.
"What are we supposed to do with this?" Rachel asked.
"Just pop it," Nick encouraged. Rachel looked at it, giggling.
"I'm afraid. I feel like some alien creature is going to burst out of it."
"Here, stand back. I'll pop it for you," Mehmet, who was on her right, offered.
"No, no, I'll do it," Rachel said bravely.
She gave it a jab with her fork, and the bubble immediately collapsed on itself, releasing a burst of pungent medicinal steam into the air. As the filmy pink membrane met the surface of the soup, it created a beautiful marbleized pattern across its surface. Rachel could now see an enormous poached scallop in the middle of the bowl and thinly julienned black mushrooms artfully positioned like sun rays around it.
"I gather the bubble was the ginseng," Mehmet said. "It's always guesswork when you're eating molecular cuisine, even more so when it's Pacific Rim fusion molecular cuisine. What is the name of this culinary genius again?"
"I can't remember exactly, but supposedly he trained with Chan Yan Tak before going to do an apprenticeship at El Bulli," Nick replied.
"It's really quite yummy, but I can see from my mum's expression that she's having a fit."
Four tables away, Eleanor was turning as red as the coral-beaded bolero jacket she wore over her intricately pleated Fortuny silk gown, but it had nothing to do with the soup. She had been in shock ever since she spotted Rachel on the promenade wearing the Grand Duchess Zoya sapphire necklace. Could her disapproving mother-in-law really have loaned the necklace to Rachel? Or even more unthinkable, had she given Rachel the necklace? What sort of black magic was Rachel doing at Tyersall Park?
"Are you going to drink your soup or not?" Philip asked, interrupting her thoughts. "If you're not going to have it, hand over the bowl before it gets cold."
"I've lost my appetite tonight. Here, swap seats with me. I need to talk to your sister for a minute."
Eleanor took her husband's seat and smiled prettily at Victoria, who was huddled in conversation with her cousin Dickie.
"Wow, Victoria, you should really wear jewelry more often. You look so pretty in these cognac diamonds."
Victoria wanted to roll her eyes. Eleanor had never once in 3 decades given her a compliment. But now, when she had this heap of vulgar stones on her chest, Eleanor was suddenly gushing. She was like all her other Sung sisters, so vain and materialistic. Yes, isn't it fun? Mummy gave them to me. She was in a good mood today after the wedding and was doling out heaps of jewels to everyone.
How nice for you, Eleanor said breezily. And isn't that Mummy's sapphire necklace on Rachel Chu's neck?
Yes, doesn't it look marvelous on her? Mummy thought so too, Victoria said with a smile. She knew perfectly well that Fiona had been given the necklace and had loaned it to Rachel after that delicious scene on the stairs with Eddie that Ling Che had breathlessly reenacted for her. But she chose not to share that detail with Eleanor. Far more amusing to see Eleanor get worked up over nothing.
Alamak, aren't you the least bit concerned about Rachel? Eleanor queried.
Concerned about what? Victoria asked, knowing full well what Eleanor meant.
Well, her dubious family background, for starters.
Oh, come on, Eleanor, you need to stop being so old-fashioned. Nobody cares about that kind of stuff anymore. Rachel is so well-educated and down-to-earth, and she speaks perfect Mandarin. She took care to mention all the things Eleanor was not.
I didn't know she spoke perfect Mandarin, Eleanor said, getting more worried by the minute.
Yes, she's very accomplished. Why, I had the most fascinating conversation with her this morning about the importance of microlending in sub-Saharan Africa. You should feel lucky that Nikki has a girlfriend like her, and not someone like that spendthrift Araminta Lee. Can you imagine what the Koos must be thinking right now, sitting here in the middle of this mosquito-infested jungle eating this absurd food? I'm so bloody sick of this Chinese fusion trend. I mean, it says on this menu card that this is caramelized Peking duck y chocolat mole, but it looks like peanut brittle. Where's the duck? I ask you, where's the damn duck?
Will you excuse me a moment? Eleanor said, getting up from the table abruptly.
Francesca was just about to take a pensive first bite into her Hawaiian suckling pig truffle tacos when Eleanor interrupted her.
Will you please come with me at once?
Eleanor walked her into one of the cavern-like lounges surrounding the main banquet hall. She sank into a white mohair ottoman and inhaled deeply as Francesca bent over her in concern, the ruffles on her flame-orange ball gown billowing around her like frothy waves.
Are you okay, Auntie Elle? You look like you're having a panic attack.
I think I am. I need my Xanax. Can you get me some water? And please blow out all those candles. The smell is giving me a migraine.
Francesca quickly returned with a glass of water. Eleanor downed a few pills quickly and sighed.
It's worse than I thought. Far worse.
What do you mean?
Did you see that sapphire necklace on that girl?
How could I miss it? Yesterday she was wearing Anne Taylor Loft, and today she's in an Ellie Saab gown from next season. And those sapphires? It's my mother-in-law's. It used to belong to the Grand Duchess Zoya of St. Petersburg, and now it's been given to that girl. What's more, the whole family seems to have fallen in love with her, even my bitchy sister-in-law, Eleanor said, almost choking on the words.
Francesca looked grave.
Don't worry, Auntie Elle. I promised you I would see to it, and after tonight, Rachel Chu will wish she had never set foot on this island.
After the sixth and final course had been served, the lights in the great hall dimmed, and a voice boomed out,
"Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our very special guest."
The live band struck up a tune, and the wall of glass behind the stage began to part. The water in the lagoon started to glow an iridescent aquamarine before draining away completely, and from the middle of the lagoon, the figure of a woman rose up as if by magic. As she walked slowly toward the banquet hall, someone screamed,
"Oh my goodness, it's Tracy Kwan!"
The usually grim-faced vice premier of China jumped out of his seat and began clapping like a man possessed as everyone in the hall cheered and rose to a standing ovation.
"Who's that?" Rachel asked, amazed by the huge surge of excitement.
"It's Tracy Kwan. She's like the Barbara Streisand of Asia. Oh my God, I can die now."
Oliver practically swooned, getting all choked up.
"Tracy Kwan is still alive?"
Cassandra Shang turned in astonishment to Jacqueline Ling.
"The woman must be at least 103 by now, and she doesn't look a day over 40. What on earth does she do to herself?"
Whale vomit from New Zealand. Works miracles on your face, Jacqueline shot back in dead seriousness. Tracy Kwan sang Dolly Parton's classic, I Will Always Love You, with alternating verses in English and Mandarin as the lagoon outside began to shoot elaborate fountain jets of water into the sky, synchronized to the music. Colin led Araminta onto the dance floor, and the crowd oohed and aahed as they danced to the ballad. When the song was over, all of the surfaces along the stage suddenly transformed into giant LED panels, projecting rapid stop-motion video sequences as Tracy Kwan launched into her classic dance hit, People Like Us. The crowd roared in approval and rushed onto the dance floor. Oliver grabbed Cecilia Cheng by the arm and said, You are under orders from your grandmother to help me. I'm going to cut in on Alistair and Kitty, and you need to keep your baby brother distracted. All I need is one song alone with Kitty. Kitty and Alistair were grinding against each other feverishly when Oliver and Cecilia cut in. Alistair, giving up Kitty reluctantly. How is he supposed to dirty dance with his own sister?
You've got the best moves on the dance floor,
Oliver yelled into Kitty's ear as Cecilia steered Alistair closer to the stage.
I dance backup for Aaron Kwok. That's how I got my start in the industry,
Kitty yelled back to Oliver as she continued to shimmy wildly.
I know. I recognized you the minute I saw you the other day. You were wearing a short platinum blonde wig in Aaron Kwok's music video,
Oliver replied, expertly herding her toward a strategic point on the dance floor without her realizing it.
Wow, you have a good memory, Kitty said, feeling flattered.
I also remember you from your other video.
Oh, which one?
The all-girl backdoor action one, Oliver said with a little wink.
Kitty didn't miss a beat.
Oh, I've heard about that video. That girl supposedly looks a lot like me, she shouted back at Oliver with a smirk.
Yes, yes, she's your identical twin. Don't worry, Kitty. Your secret is safe with me. I'm a survivor just like you, and I know you didn't work your pretty ass off, quite literally, I might add, to end up married to an upper middle-class boy like my cousin.
You're wrong about me. I love Alistair, Kitty protested.
Of course you do. I never said you didn't,
Oliver replied, spinning her right next to Bernard Tai, who was dancing with Lauren Lee.
Lauren Lee, my goodness, I haven't seen you since last year's Hong Kong Art Fair. Where have you been hiding yourself?
Oliver exclaimed as he switched partners with Bernard. As Bernard began to ogle Kitty's skimpily suave décolletage, Oliver whispered into Kitty's ear,
Bernard's father, Dato Taito Lui, has about $4 billion, and he's the only son.
Kitty continued to dance as if she hadn't heard a single word. Seeking respite from the ear-splitting music, Astrid headed outdoors and climbed onto one of the terraces overlooking a canopy of treetops. Charlie noticed her leaving the banquet hall, and it took every ounce of determination for him not to follow her. He was better off admiring her from afar, in the way that he always had. Even when they were living together in London, he loved nothing more than to watch her quietly as she drifted through a room in her inimitable way. Astrid had always stood apart from any woman he had ever known, especially tonight when the most stylish women in all of Asia were dressed to impress and drowning in diamonds. Astrid outdid all of them by appearing in a flawlessly elegant cheongsam and an exquisitely simple pair of chalcedony drop earrings. He knew from the tailoring and intricately embroidered peacock feathers that the cheongsam had to be vintage, likely one of her grandmother's. What the hell? He didn't care how she might feel. He needed to see her again up close.
Let me guess. Not a fan of Tracy Kwan?
Astrid asked when she saw Charlie walking up the steps onto the terrace.
Not when I have no one to dance with.
Astrid smiled.
I'd happily dance with you, but you know the press would have a field day without one.
We'd wipe this wedding off the front pages tomorrow, wouldn't we? Charlie laughed.
Tell me, Charlie, back in our day, were we anything like Colin and Araminta?
Astrid sighed, peering down at the fantastical harbor, its row of Grecian columns like leftover props from the set of Cleopatra.
I'd like to think we weren't. I mean, kids these days, the spending is on a whole other level.
Spending Agong's money, as they say, Astrid quipped.
Yes, but at least we had the sense to feel naughty spending Grandpa's money. And I think that back in those days when we lived in London, we were buying things we actually loved, not things to show off, Charlie mused.
No one in Singapore gave a damn about Martin Margiela back then, Astrid laughed.
It's a whole new world, Astrid, Charlie sighed.
Well, I hope Colin and Araminta live happily ever after, Astrid said wistfully.
They were silent for a minute, taking in the calm of the rustling trees, mingling with the low bass thump coming from the great hall. Suddenly, the relative quiet was broken as Asia's bright young things flooded out onto the plaza in a raucous conga line led by the indefatigable Tracy Kwan doing her best rendition of the B-52's Love Shack.
I can't lie to you, Astrid. My wife was invited tonight, but she's not here because we lead separate lives. We haven't lived together in more than 2 years, Charlie said over the din, slumping onto one of the lucite benches.
I'm sorry to hear that, Astrid said, jarred by his candor.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, my husband isn't really away on business.
He's in Hong Kong with his mistress, she blurted out before she could stop herself.
Charlie stared at her, incredulous.
Mistress? How could anyone in his right mind be cheating on you?
That's what I've been asking myself all night. A week, actually. I had been suspecting it for the past few months, but he finally came clean a week ago before abruptly moving out.
He moved to Hong Kong?
No, I don't think so. Actually, what am I talking about? I have no idea. I think his mistress lives there, and I think he went specifically this weekend just to spite me. It was the one weekend where his absence would surely be noticed.
Fucker.
That's not all. I think he fathered a child with this woman, Astrid said sadly.
Charlie looked at her in horror.
You think? Or you know?
I don't really know, Charlie. There are so many things about this whole affair that don't make sense to me at all.
Then why don't you go to Hong Kong yourself and find out?
How can I? There's no way I can run off to Hong Kong on my own to check up on him. You know how it is. No matter where I stay, someone is bound to recognize me and there will be talk, Astrid said, rather resigned to her fate.
Well, why don't we find out?
What do you mean, we?
I mean, I'm going to call my pilot right now to get the plane fueled up, and we can be in Hong Kong in 3 hours. Let me help you. You can stay with me, and no one will know you're in Hong Kong. It's unfortunate, but after my brother's kidnapping 8 years ago, I have access to the best private investigators in the city.
Let's get to the bottom of this, Charlie said eagerly.
Oh, Charlie, I can't just leave in the middle of all this.
Why the hell not? I don't see you out there shaking your ass in that conga line.
Colin and Nick were standing by one of the alcoves, watching Peter Lee spin his daughter around the dance floor.
I can't quite believe I got married to that girl today, Nikki. This whole day has been a complete fucking blur,
Colin sighed wearily.
Yeah. It's been quite surreal, Nick admitted.
Well, I'm glad you've been with me on this ride, Colin said. I know I haven't been easy on you the last few days.
Hey, what are friends for?
Nick said cheerily, putting his arm around Colin. He was not about to let Colin get maudlin on his wedding night.
I'm going to do you the favor of not asking you when your turn's going to be, although I must say Rachel looks smashing tonight,
Colin said, staring at her being whirled around by Mehmet.
Doesn't she? Nick grinned. I'd cut in on them if I were you. You know how lethal our Turkish friend can be, especially since he knows how to tango better than an Argentinian polo player,
Colin warned.
Oh, Mehmet already confessed to me that he thinks Rachel has the sexiest legs on the planet.
Nick laughed.
You know how they say weddings are infectious. I think I really caught the bug today watching you and Araminta during the ceremony.
Does this mean what I think it does? Colin asked, perking up.
I think so, Colin. I think I'm finally ready to ask Rachel to marry me.
Well, hurry up, La!
Colin exclaimed, clapping Nick on the back.
Araminta already told me she intends to get pregnant on our honeymoon, so you need to catch up. I'm counting on your kid to check my kid into rehab.
It was almost midnight, and while the older guests were perched comfortably on terraces overlooking the promenade, sipping their Remy Martins or Lapsang Souchongs, Rachel was sitting with the few remaining girls in the banquet hall, catching up with Sophie Koo. Lauren Lee and Mandy Ling were chatting several chairs away when Francesca sauntered up to the table.
Wasn't that dinner a disappointment? That edible bird's nest semifreddo at the end? Why would you ever puree bird's nest? Bird's nest is all about the texture, and that idiot chef transforms it into a half-frozen muck, Francesca complained. We should all go for supper after the fireworks.
Why don't we just go now? Lauren suggested.
No, we have to stay for the fireworks. Araminta told me in secret that Kai Guo Qiang designed a pyrotechnic show even more spectacular than the one he did for the Beijing Olympics. But we'll take the first ferry the minute the show is over. Now, where should we go?
I don't know Singapore well at all anymore. If I was in Sydney right now, I'd be heading to Barbecue King for a late-night snack, Sophie said.
Ooh, Barbecue King. I love that place. I think they have the best siu nyap in the world, Lauren declared.
Aya, Barbecue King is such a grease pit. Everyone knows that Four Seasons in London has the best roast duck in the world, Mandy countered.
I'm with Lauren. I think Barbecue wins hands down, Francesca said.
No, I find their roast duck too fatty. The duck at Four Seasons is perfect because they raise the ducks on their own special organic farm. Nico would agree with me. We used to go there all the time, Mandy added with a flourish.
Why do you call Nick Nico? Rachel turned to Mandy, the curiosity finally getting the better of her.
Oh, when we were just teenagers, we spent one summer together on Capri. His auntie Catherine, the Taiwan, took a villa there. We would follow the sun all day, start out sunbathing at the beach club by the Faraglioni rocks in the mornings, go swimming at Grotta Verde after lunch, and end up at Il Faro Beach for sunset. We got so brown, and Nicky's hair got so long, he looked practically Italian. That's when the Italian kids we made friends with started calling him Nico, and I was his Mandy. Oh, it was such a glorious time.
Sounds like it. Rachel said lightly, ignoring Mandy's blatant attempt to make her jealous by resuming her conversation with Sophie.
Francesca leaned into Mandy's ear.
Really, Mandy? I could have milked that story way better. Your mother is right. You have lost your edge living in New York.
Go to hell, Francesca. I don't see you doing any better, Mandy said through gritted teeth as she got up from the table.
She was fed up with the pressure coming at her from all sides and wished she'd never agreed to come back. The girls looked up as Mandy stormed off.
Francesca shook her head slowly and gave Rachel a look.
Poor Mandy is so conflicted. She doesn't know what she wants anymore. I mean, that was such a pathetic attempt at inciting jealousy, wasn't it?
For once, Rachel had to agree with Francesca.
It didn't work, and I don't understand why she keeps trying to make me jealous. I mean, why would I care about what Nick and her did when they were teenagers?
Francesca burst out laughing.
Wait a minute. You thought she was trying to make you jealous?
Wasn't that what she was doing?
No, honey, she's not paying any attention to you. She was trying to make me jealous.
You? Rachel asked, puzzled.
Francesca smirked.
Of course. That's why she brought up the whole Capri story. I was there that summer too, you know.
Mandy's never gotten over how into me Nick was when we had our threesome.
Rachel could feel her face get hot, very hot. She wanted to bolt from the table, but her legs seemed to have turned to glue.
Sophie and Lauren stared at Francesca, mouths agape.
Francesca looked straight into Rachel's face and kept on chattering lightly.
Oh, does Nick still do that trick with the underside of his tongue? Mandy was far too prissy to let him go down on her, but my God, on me he would stay down there for hours.
Right then, Nick entered the banquet hall.
There you are. Why are you all sitting in here like statues? The fireworks are about to start.
Chapter 9. 99 Conduit Road. Hong Kong. The elderly Ama opened the door and broke out into a wide grin.
Hiya! Astrid Leong! Can it be? She cried in Cantonese.
Yes, Archie. Astrid will be our guest for a few days.
Will you please make sure no one knows? And don't go telling any of the other maids who she is. I don't want them carrying tales to my mother's maids. This needs to remain absolutely secret, okay?
Charlie decreed.
Yes, yes, of course, Charlie boy. Now go and wash your hands, Archie said dismissively, continuing to fuss over Astrid.
Hiya! You are still so beautiful. I have dreamed about you often over the years. You must be so tired, so hungry. It's past 3 in the morning. Let me go and wake the cook up to make you something to eat. Some chicken congee, maybe?
No need, Archie. We came from a wedding banquet.
Astrid smiled. She could hardly believe that Charlie's childhood nanny was still looking after him after all these years.
Well, let me go make you some warm milk and honey. Or would you rather have Milo?
Charlie Bo always likes that when he's up late, Archie said, rushing off to the kitchen.
There's no stopping Archie, is there? Astrid laughed. I'm so glad you still have her.
She won't leave, Charlie sputtered in exasperation. I built her a house back in China. Hell, I built all her relatives' houses, got a satellite dish for the village, the whole 9 yards, thinking she would want to return to China to retire. But I think she's much happier here bossing all the other maids around.
It's very sweet of you to take care of her like that, Astrid said. They stepped into an expansive double-height living room that resembled the wing of a modern art museum, with its row of bronze sculptures placed like sentinels in front of the floor-to-ceiling windows.
Since when did you collect Brancouche? She asked in surprise.
Since you introduced me to him. Don't you remember that exhibition you dragged me to at the Pompidou?
Gosh, I'd almost forgotten, Astrid said, gazing at the minimalist curves of one of Brancouche's golden birds.
My wife, Isabelle, is mad for the French Provençal look, so she hates my Brancouches. They haven't had an airing until I moved in here. I've turned this apartment into a sort of refuge for my art. Isabelle and the girls stay at our house on the peak, and I'm here in the mid-levels. I like it because I can just walk out my door, take the escalator down to Central, and be at my office within 10 minutes. Sorry, it's a bit cramped. It's just a small duplex.
It's gorgeous, Charlie, and much larger than my flat.
You're kidding, right?
No, I'm not. I'm in a 3-bedroom off Clemenceau Avenue. You know that 80s building across the street from the Istana?
What on earth are you doing living in that old tear-down?
It's a long story. Basically, Michael didn't want to feel beholden to my dad, so I agreed to live in a place he could afford.
I suppose that's admirable, although I just can't imagine how he could make you squeeze into a pigeonhole for the sake of his pride.
Charlie huffed.
Oh, I'm quite used to it, and the location is very convenient, just like here, Astrid said.
Charlie couldn't help but wonder what sort of life Astrid had made for herself since marrying this idiot.
Here, let me show you to your room, Charlie said.
They climbed the sleek brushed metal staircase, and he showed her into a large, spartanly furnished bedroom with top-stitched beige suede walls and masculine gray flannel bedding. The only decorative object was a photograph of 2 young girls in a silver frame by the bedside.
Is this your bedroom? She asked.
Yes. Don't worry. I'm going to sleep in my daughter's room, Charlie quickly added.
Don't be silly. I'll take the girl's room. I can't make you give up your bedroom for me, Astrid began.
No, no, I insist. You'll be much more comfortable here. Try to get some sleep, Charlie said, closing the door gently before she could protest any more.
Astrid changed out of her clothes and lay down. She turned on her side and stared out the floor-to-ceiling windows that perfectly framed the Hong Kong skyline. The buildings were densely packed in this part of the city, staggered steeply on the mountainside in sheer defiance of the terrain. She remembered how, when she had first visited Hong Kong as a young girl, her Aunt Alex had explained that the city's feng shui was particularly good, because wherever you lived, the Dragon Mountain was always behind you, and the ocean was always in front of you. Even at this late hour, the city was a riot of lights, with many of the skyscrapers illuminated in a spectrum of colors. She tried to sleep, but she was still too wired from the past few hours. Stealing away from the wedding just as the fireworks show was starting, rushing home to pack a few things, and now finding herself in the bedroom of Charlie Wu, the boy whose heart she had broken. The boy who, strangely enough, had awakened her to another way of life. Paris, 1995. Astrid Lee